Welcome to Culturetopia, NPR's roundup of the week's very best arts and cultural stories. I am Neda Ulibi. This week, a television-centric Culturetopia. We'll start with a look ahead at the slew of shows starting this month, from the return of American Idol on Fox to HBO series Luck. Then, a profile of one of the most powerful writers and producers in Hollywood, who happens to be black, female, and Muslim. Mara Brock-Akil produces one of the biggest hits on cable, the BET series, The Game. And a look at the big money in televised sports. Whether you watch or not, cable subscribers all subsidize live sporting events. ESPN collects almost $5 for every cable home, four times more than any other network. But first,
a tax on tummy tucks and facelifts is itself under the knife in New Jersey. Lawmakers there have voted to phase out the so-called Botox, a 6% tax on cosmetic surgery and other elective procedures like Botox. As NPR's Joel Rose reports, New Jersey is one of just a few states with such a tax, a distinction that plastic surgeons have been working hard to erase.
If you watch much TV, you probably know that the Real Housewives of New Jersey are no strangers to the surgeon's knife.
I'm sure she's had a nose job. She's gotten Botox galore.
I'm trying to think of something that is real. Her hair is not, her lips are not, her nose is not. I'm not sure about her nose. Maybe her nose is real.
Those housewives may be able to save a few dollars next season if plastic surgeons in New Jersey get their way. They're urging state lawmakers to phase out a 6% tax on cosmetic surgery and similar elective procedures.
Patients go into other states without the tax to have their procedures performed to save that 6%.
Dr. Christopher Godek runs the Personal Enhancement Center in Toms River near the Jersey Shore. He's also president of the New Jersey Society of Plastic Surgeons. The organization commissioned an economic study which suggests that New Jersey is actually losing revenues because of the tax on cosmetic surgery, not gaining them.
When someone has plastic surgery, they're not only coming to a plastic surgeon, they're utilizing a hospital or a surgery center, they're staying in local hotels, their family is eating in local restaurants, they're utilizing pharmacies to fill their prescriptions, so all of that revenue is lost.
This is not how New Jersey's tax on cosmetic surgery was supposed to work. Here's State Assemblyman Joseph Cryan explaining the rationale on CBS's The Early Show back in 2005.
This is an income situation where people are able to afford elective surgery. They're not medical necessities. Clearly, reconstructive surgery would not be part of it. So it's optional surgery designed to enhance to one's appearance as opposed to the necessity or quality of one's life.
Cosmetic surgery was a big quality of life improvement for Jennifer Farley, better known as JWoww on the show Jersey Shore. She sounded like an advertisement for breast implants in this interview with Access Hollywood.
When did you get them? When did they come into your life?
20. I was 20. It's my 21st birthday present.
You bought it for yourself?
Yeah.
Any regrets?
No. I would do it every year if I had to. I would regret not doing them. I recommend that for anybody.
Even with that endorsement, New Jersey's tax on cosmetic surgery is only bringing in about $10 million a year, less than half of what was projected. Lawmakers voted last week to phase it out completely over the next few years. But those revenues, however modest, go into a special fund that reimburses hospitals for charity care, where they're matched by federal dollars. And that's what makes Suzanne Ianni at the Hospital Alliance of New Jersey concerned.
This is actually bringing in dollars to New Jersey that otherwise we wouldn't be able to get. You know, reversing these assessments that draw down federal monies, I feel, is going in the wrong direction.
So did former Governor John Corzine, a Democrat. In 2007, he vetoed a similar bill that would have snipped New Jersey's tax on cosmetic surgery. The current governor, Republican Chris Christie, has until tomorrow to decide if he'll do the same. Joel Rose, NPR News.
We have a story now on the latest crackdown in China. It's a crackdown on excessive entertainment. Beijing's propaganda czars have taken aim at dating shows and game shows. They've cut almost 70% of the entertainment shows from primetime TV. As NPR's Louisa Lim reports from Beijing, this is part of a larger ideological campaign.
tens of millions of people tune in every week to the Chinese dating show Take Me Out. It's pure entertainment. Girls in skimpy dresses hoping for a date, sweaty geeky guys stammering questions, and two effete hosts with matching bouffant hairstyles. But as of last week, Take Me Out was bumped from prime time. Instead, its millions of fans got Ordinary Hero, uplifting tales of ordinary people doing heroic things, like a firefighter saving a 10-year-old kid stuck in an elevator. This is a move to promote traditional virtues and socialist core values. The fans, including Michael Jung, a dating show aficionado, are not happy.
This rule is, most people don't like it. We definitely show our disagreement on it. I believe the shows should be driven by the market.
This is, in effect, a government U-turn, according to Hu Xingdou, a political analyst at Beijing Institute of Technology.
The government led this move towards consumerism and entertainment mania. They urged people not to get involved with politics, suggesting politics is too dangerous. Go and earn money and have fun. But now in China, it's gone too far. We've amused ourselves to death and morality has almost collapsed.
That moral collapse has showed itself in rampant money worship, transfixing television audiences. This dating show contestant told a potential suitor that a boyfriend would have to earn $30,000 a month to even hold her hand. But limitations on TV content are nothing new. Interviewed even before the latest clampdown, author Mu Rong Xuecun described the situation as almost farcical.
At one time, all you could see on TV were court dramas from the Qing dynasty, but then those were restricted. It's the same with almost every genre. Then family dramas were banned if they included love triangles or affairs. Spy dramas were restricted. Now you can't shoot anything with ghosts in it, although you can have monsters. I hosted a TV show, and we weren't even allowed to use the words time travel.
Culture has been top of the political agenda for months. President Hu Jintao recently wrote of international hostile forces strengthening their efforts to westernize and divide China, using ideology and culture. But analyst Hu Xingdou doesn't believe the official line.
I don't think this has much to do with division and westernization. The young people have already been westernized. The battlefield of public opinion that they're really fighting over is how to control the intellectuals. But mostly the intellectuals aren't buying it.
For the first time in two decades, a Hong Kong TV drama, When Heaven Burns, has been forbidden on the mainland. The cultural purge could yet go further still. A new draft law governing the film industry would ban movies featuring religious fanaticism, gambling, drug abuse, and even horror. Hao Jian, a professor at Beijing Film Academy, believes that in yielding to their tendency to control, China's leaders are highlighting their own insecurities.
We feel tighter and tighter controls on politics, on Twitter, on entertainment, and on TV news. Our political system is wary of the outside world, even hostile to it. Sometimes we say it has a persecution complex. It always feels people are infiltrating us, attacking us, westernizing us. It's a very fearful psychological state.
The fear is such that this year, even Supergirl, a singing contest, is banned. That stormed the ratings 6 years ago. 8 million votes were cast in the final alone, making it arguably the most open election in China. The danger is that by tightening their grip on entertainment, China's leaders are neutering their own artists and alienating many millions of non-political youth who only want to relax and be entertained. Louisa Lim, NPR News, Beijing.
This is prime time for sports fans who like to watch TV. There's been a full slate of college bowl games. The NFL playoffs are still going on. There's hockey's Winter Classic the other day. The NBA, you get the idea. These days, cable TV is giving subscribers more sports choices than ever. And as commentator Frank DeFord points out, even if you are not watching, you're still paying.
For the many reasons that the Republican presidential debates have been so popular, The main one is simply that they're live, happening right before our eyes. When Rick Perry says, oops, he's saying it just as we're hearing it. Live. Wow. Oops. This is why, whether you like sports or not, why perhaps you desperately prefer NPR to have somebody else right now talking about something really important, not sports, why nonetheless each month you're charged about $8 on your cable bill for the privilege of not watching sports. Pay up for sports or you don't get anything else you might want to watch on cable unlive. You see, games are about the last thing scheduled live on television. Not edited for time, not taped news packages, not delayed by time zone. And there are more than enough fans who do want to watch games, so that sports pretty much hold all cable subscribers hostage. It's where the money is. It's why professional leagues and teams and college conferences all now want to have their own cable networks. And it's why last week Comcast renamed one of its properties NBC Sports Network. All sports, all day, all year. The better to try to get a larger share of what ESPN does. ESPN now collects an average of $4.69 for every cable home, four times more than any other network. Throw in the various other ESPN channels plus other sports networks, like that new NBC Sports, that your cable provider makes you pay for, and there's that $8 for sports on your monthly bill. Or as the CEO of Liberty Media describes it, a tax on every American household. Understand, ESPN is an entirely different programming animal than, say, is CBS, which dominates primetime, or A&E, or HBO, or Showtime on cable. Those networks must create programming. But ESPN and the other sports networks are essentially just brokers. They take your subscription money, buy games, and then, quote, bring them, unquote, to you, pocketing a nice broker's fee. And because games are live, advertisers love it because you can't fast-forward their commercials. It's a great business model, taxing American households. The new NBC Sports Network says it doesn't want to be like ESPN. I watched some NBC SN last week. In fact, it was just like ESPN. Only not nearly so good. Who are they kidding? Why wouldn't they want to be exactly like ESPN so they can buy more live games with your money to bring to you? Sure, you can watch everything on tape now, on DVD, on YouTube, on your iPad, on your Nook. But games are about the only thing left scheduled live for real.
Commentator Frank DeFord is for real. He joins us each Wednesday from member station WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut.
One of the most popular shows on cable television returns tonight to the network BET. The Game is about the people who really run pro football, the players' wives and girlfriends. NPR's Netta Ulaby says the creator of The Game is a Hollywood rarity.
Mara Brock-Akil is black, Muslim, and a mother of two. She's been one of television's most powerful women since 2000, when she created a show that ran on UPN, then the CW network, for 8 years.
I'm going for coffee with Stan.
Oh, I know all about that kind of coffee. Strong, black, and hot.
Girlfriends was about a group of smart, funny women who talked about everything from Zora Neale Hurston to men. Well, mostly men. Mara Brock-Akil started working in television soon after graduating from Northwestern University and realized her fellow writers were missing something.
I started by like, well, I don't think a woman would say that. You know, I don't think that's really our experience, or it's not every woman's experience. It really started with that. Then I was like, well, I don't think that, like, hey, wait a minute, where is a black woman in this story?
Black women are the heart of The Game. The main character is a medical student. Her boyfriend is a rookie wide receiver on an NFL team. He coaches her through exams.
Baby, you need to know this stuff. You getting through med school is all we have to fall back on if this football thing doesn't work out. So, come on, girl. You still might be able to save your patient.
Viral meningitis.
That's my girl!
Yes!
But here's the catch. His success depends on how well she fits in with a smug sorority of football wives.
Isn't your man a third-string wide receiver?
Yeah.
Why are you even talking?
Glamour and wealth are part of The Game's allure. But it's also about families, the sport's intense physical danger, and pro football's stew of race and class.
Oftentimes you'll see that I hit the stereotype dead on.
Come on, Malik. It's only 30 seconds left in the game. Don't do anything stupid.
The stereotype of a lot of athletes are they come from the ghetto. They buy their mama a house. They're loud and audacious.
But Mara Brock-Akil wants to create relatable characters, not cartoons. And she mixes in topical issues, like a player on the down low. When he comes out as gay, one teammate is horrified and needs to get talked down by the light-skinned captain.
Who was discriminated against before the quiz? Us, dude.
Football players?
African-Americans, idiot. Gay rights are no different than civil rights.
You know what? That'd be a lot more convincing if you were darker.
The Game aired on the CW for 3 seasons. Then it got canceled.
It was very humbling for me. I'm a winner, so to speak, meaning even if it doesn't look like I'm winning, I believe I'm winning. But that time, it was kind of rough.
But then something happened that almost never happens. BET took on The Game. TV critic James Poniewozik says the show drew almost 8 million people when it started its 4th season.
That outdraws most of the regular run programming on NBC on any night, you know, excepting maybe football. Maybe it helps that The Game has football involved in it, although, you know, that also didn't help Friday Night Lights.
The Game is not a critical darling like Friday Night Lights, but Poniewozik appreciates the perspective it brings. The Game's mainly directed by Salim Akil, Mara Brock-Akil's husband. Last year, they surprised many in Hollywood with a hit movie.
Mom, this is Sabrina.
Oh, hello.
Jumping the Broom, like so much of the Akil's work, explores race and class. Mara Brock-Akil says she and her husband brainstorm while they're driving around.
You just go for a ride, and we just start talking. And, you know, I was thinking, and then next thing you know, you have this incredible character or a series or a movie idea or whatever. And it really happens a lot just driving around, grab a coffee, grab a tea.
Mixing the serious with the silly is Mara Brock-Akil's stock and trade. But she has yet to write a character who shares her deeply felt Muslim faith.
It has to be the right moment, the right character at the right time. And I do think it's coming close.
First, though, the Akils are remaking the movie Sparkle from 1976 that's loosely based on the story of the Supremes. Then a new TV show about black women and marriage. Mara Brock-Akil says there's a powerful conversation to have about that topic, and she says TV is a powerful way for her to lead it. Netta Ulibi, NPR News.
We have a pile of new shows this winter season and new episodes of returning shows, including the biggest series of all, American Idol. Eric Deggans of the Tampa Bay Times joins us once again to help sort through the options. Welcome, Eric.
Thank you.
Let's start with your favorite TV show of the season coming up.
Yeah, my favorite has got to be Justified. This is entering its 3rd season on FX, and it's about this U.S. Marshal by the name of Raylan Givens. And he's in the modern world, but his attitude is really more like an old-school gunslinger-type marshal. And he constantly has to pull himself back from shooting and killing people who cross him. And now he finds himself in this weird position where he wants to settle down while also chasing down some of the most dangerous criminals in Kentucky. And I think we've got a clip here that shows him in a fight with his arch rival and also, weirdly, an old friend, Boyd Crowder.
I am a deputy U.S. Marshal, Boyd.
You're a Givens, Raylan.
And you think I'm going to hand a man over to you to be murdered like he is what? Some pig I borrowed from you?
You gave me your word.
I got half a mind to kick you.
And the fight starts. Boys will be boys, you know.
Another show, police show that you're interested in is Southland, right? And I remember this being on network TV and then kind of bouncing to one of the sort of cable channels after suffering in the ratings.
Yeah, you know, Southland was an NBC show, and it really had the unfortunate luck of debuting the season before NBC decided to give Jay Leno his own show at 10 p.m. and blow out all the 10 p.m. dramas. So they had a season where they struggled in the ratings, and NBC canceled them. But TNT picked them up. It's still, I think, one of the best depictions of an urban police force that's on television now. I can't watch the Law and Orders and the CSIs. They're a little too fantastical for me. But Southland is about getting inside the head of cops.
Okay, so you've given us the lowdown on some returning favorites. But are there any freshmen, any new shows that you love?
Well, everybody's going to look at Luck, which is the new HBO series starring Dustin Hoffman. That premieres later in the month. It's almost a feature film that's been stretched out over a series. Dustin Hoffman is playing a gangster who gets out of jail and decides to buy a racehorse.
Beautiful day at the track. And say the jackpot will top $3 million.
Good luck.
So all the action is centered on the racetrack. And the creative minds behind this are David Milch, who we know created Deadwood and also was the creative force behind NYPD Blue, and Michael Mann, who was the creative force behind Miami Vice. And what I love about this series is that it is about middle-aged guys, from the richest gangster to the losers who, you know, lose their welfare check at the track every week. And there's no series out there who really focuses on middle-aged guys and all their crusty glory.
So, Eric, let's help everyone save some time and talk about the shows they shouldn't bother watching.
Okay, well, there's a show on CBS called Rob that just started. Stars Rob Schneider, who used to be in Saturday Night Live and the Deuce Bigelow movies. And he actually married a Latina woman. And so the comedy is based around this idea of him marrying a woman he doesn't know well and then trying to get to know her Mexican-American family. And it's just awful. It's a bad sitcom, and it piles stereotypes on top of it. He says he feels like he's at a Julio Iglesias concert when he's hanging out with her family. It's just terrible. ABC has another comedy that's also pretty bad called Work It, about men who have to dress up like women to get work.
And why do people hate this show so much? Because, I mean, I've watched a few Bosom Buddies episodes in the past. Like, what went wrong here?
Well, two things. I think representatives of the transgender community said it encourages people to make fun of men who dress like women. And then some feminists are upset because they feel like it exaggerates this idea of the man session, men losing jobs more than women in the recession, which was true early on but does not seem to be so true now.
Lots to choose from, Eric. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Eric Deggans is a TV and media critic for the Tampa Bay Times.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. Culturetopia is produced by Mike Katziff and executive produced by Sarah Sarrazin. I am Netta Ulaby. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.